Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Weather State Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, fresh off of Vancouver Real Estate Live last night. Taylor Blue Steel.
He blew the doors off that one.
It was such a good time. If you are joining us for these Vancouver Real Estate Live episodes on YouTube, where you can actually participate and hang out, have a beer, relax, ask questions, talk anything real estate, we appreciate it. But also, if you're not, you should be.
Yeah, I mean, just to give people an idea of what it is, it's basically we sit down, have a beer, and engage with people on the internet. It's basically, it's talking real estate for an hour, talking whatever anyone wants to talk about, and it's such a good time.
It is a good time. And today's guest, Matt, is none other than finance professor and SFU professor from the Beattie School of Business, Andre Pavlov.
So you might remember Andre from the last time he was on when he debated Tom Davidoff on our program. That was a phenomenal episode. This episode is fantastic as well. He's actually going to join us on the next Vancouver Real Estate Live. So if you're interested in talking to Andre Pavlov in mid-January, we're going to announce that one. That's going to be super exciting as well. But this doesn't disappoint. We haven't had somebody of Andre's stature on in a while.
He has such a strong command of not only what's going on in the market or about different real estate markets in general, but also like he's so driven by what's going on in the policy. They're doing studies on the areas that are kind of most open to density. There's so much that comes out of this. Like if you're interested in policy or the market in general, you're going to love this. If you're an investor, you're going to love this. If you're a homeowner or just somebody who loves Vancouver, you're going to love this. This is a great episode.
This is if you like the idea of private property.
You're going to love this.
as a concept, you're going to love this.
Yeah.
Exactly. But there's tons here. So stay tuned for that.
But before we get to our interview with Andre, Matt, we also have the Oakland tip.
And the Oakland tip is always preceded by our tip now. We used to do a jingle.
It's your, and then we scrapped the jingle, we scrapped secret. And now we're doing a tip before. And this is, I think it's this, this is your turn.
It's my turn. And this is kind of off the cuff tips just for anyone out there listening.
Mostly movies.
Mainly
Netflix and Over the Hill, not chill. it's the post 40 guys reviewing Netflix.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm only 38. I just looked 45.
Exactly. So the Netflix and Over the Hill component of the show. I like that. This week I got one for you. It's do not watch, especially if you're married. Marriage Story.
Yeah.
This is...
I think we both watched it the same night.
And I don't know if you went into a tailspin as well.
My relationship.
Back in therapy. Back in therapy. Yeah. Marriage counseling. I mean, not therapy.
Yeah.
But it's... that's a doozy.
Oh, man. It's a Noah Baumbach, right?
Yeah.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
I think you're pronouncing it correctly.
96% on Rotten Tomatoes, and they call it a comedy. That is the furthest thing
from a comedy. No, it's a tragedy. There's nothing comedic about how tragic that story is. And it's very realistic. It captures, I think...
Good acting. Adam Driver is phenomenal.
Actually, Scarlett Johansson is also very good.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. Just watch it by yourself.
Yeah. And actually, just don't even watch it by yourself. Great movie. Just don't watch it. And that's our tip.
But what is Oakland's tip?
Oakland's tip is get a pre-approval and a rate hold. And I love this tip for one reason specifically. Well, two reasons, let's say. The pre-approval gets all the paperwork to the broker and it gets you kind of a head start so that you're along the process. So actually when you find a property, you're actually going to be ready. The rate hold on top of that gives you security that you know what your rate is going to be. And typically it's, 90 to 120 days or so that you actually have that rate hold in effect. So you want to just, even if rates go down, you can get the lower rate, but at least you have that rate in case rates increase, right? And then the last thing that I really, really love about this is so many people go out shopping and they're out looking on the weekend and they don't think they're really quite ready. But then they see a property that they love And chances are other people love it as well. It's a pretty special property. And then they don't have the option of going subjects free because they haven't made any progress on their financing yet.
Or they're not even sure if they can actually afford it.
Sure.
That's the other thing, right?
Yeah.
So many people go out shopping thinking, I got a ballpark figure or I'm looking for X. And they haven't really run those numbers with a professional to know exactly what they can afford. And in that case, you fall in love and you break your heart.
Right. And somebody out there shopping with a rate hold, with a pre-approval, they're much better positioned now to be competitive with their offer or strategic with their offer, right?
And you know what? Last thing to say about this, and this is part of the Oakland tip, is talk to somebody at your bank, but talk to an independent broker as well.
What's your reason for talking to an independent broker? You've got a great buying a flight story.
I do have a great buy. I forgot. You know what? I don't use that anymore.
I mention it every once in a while.
Okay. So this is, yeah.
The I came up with it.
Buying the flight. Actually, a mortgage broker asked me if he could use that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Go ahead. I don't know.
Here, okay, well, now you're building it up. I got high hopes.
So the reason to use a mortgage broker is like Expedia, whereas your bank is like, I want to fly to Toronto, walking up to the Air Canada counter and saying, I got to leave in 2 hours, right?
For sure.
There's no competition. The mortgage broker, they're looking at many different lenders, many different types of products, and you can choose one that's tailored towards what your goals are. You definitely want to talk to an independent broker. They may not, in the end, get you the product, the best product.
Yeah, that's banks for you, can often outdo mortgage brokers.
But you definitely want to be comparing and contrasting, and that's the best way to do it.
Absolutely. But before we get to our interview, and I got to say, this is one of my favorite conversations we've had this year.
Yeah,
and
it's a heady one.
It's great at the end of the year to finish strong with somebody like Andre Pavlov. I'm super excited about this conversation, but we should say we were live at Bento.
Andre came down
to Live at Bento, which is obviously our other sponsor of this show. And I should say before, Live at Bento, they're doing the best thing ever, comparing and contrasting specific Vancouver food, right?
We're talking pad thai. We're talking donuts.
What else are we talking? Coffee.
We're talking coffee.
Christmas themes.
We're talking Thanksgiving. I think they did a pumpkin pie one.
Oh, yeah?
Local and regional sources.
And
for
it's
those
all
pies.
Live, and you can engage. And we're live at Live at
That's
Bento,
why we're
too.
There.
We're there, and we were there last night, Vancouver Real Estate Live with Taylor Steele, and it was a good time. So you need to be checking out Live at Bento. But Matt, let's cut to our interview with Andre Pavlov.
Enjoy, guys. This is a good one.
Okay, we're here with Andre Pavlov, professor of finance at the Beattie School of Business at Simon Fraser University. How are you doing, Andre?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time today. We really appreciate you coming out. And
Past guest, fan favorite.
Yes, for sure. But for people that don't know your work and who you are, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I mostly do research in real estate, and I've taken interest in the Vancouver real estate market and BC real estate markets in general. It's a fascinating place, and I'm lucky to be here to be able to have a close look at that.
Is there anywhere else in the world that you'd want to research real estate, like focus on? Like, I mean, Vancouver seems like such a dynamic market. Do you have a market that if you weren't working in Vancouver or looking at Vancouver, where you'd want to specialize?
Well, I've been lucky enough to have data and actually be in many other places. Yeah. I've done a bunch of work in Los Angeles, San Francisco, you know, New York, London. So a great paper recent on Brexit and London real estate prices. So, I'm not confined to Vancouver, but Vancouver is fascinating in the way that it's so unaffordable, especially to the locals.
Right. And actually, I'm just thinking out loud here. We always talk about Vancouver being a potential global city or a global city on the rise. If you're looking at, you know, the San Franciscos, the Londons, New York, do you see Vancouver as kind of part of that larger kind of global superstar cities or whatever you call them? Or do you think that's a little bit overblown?
Oh, I've got to be very careful here not to offend any of my great Vancouverites.
Nobody,
friends.
Don't worry, nobody from Vancouver is listening.
But I've got something else. I mean, it's very difficult to compare, the New York or Los Angeles art scene or live performances or that kind of stuff to Vancouver. So I don't think Vancouver is quite at that level in terms of size or what it offers. Having said that, it has a unique position to be gateway to Asia. So obviously it's physical location, but it's also, you know, being located in Canada with fairly liberal immigration policies and you know, it's not just the rules, it's also how we apply them in my view, in a pretty humane way.
Right.
I think that can serve as a bridge between the two continents, and Asia being a very dynamic place, you know, that's a unique opportunity, and I think Vancouver has carved itself a place in that connection.
Right. Right. That's kind of an interesting way to think about it, right? And it seems like now with the deep roots and the deep connections, it's almost an inevitable connection, right? That can't be severed in a lot of ways, no matter what.
It can be messed up, right? So, and you know, as I'm sure we'll talk about, we've right. done some of that.
Right.
We've done some damage. But luckily we started from a very fortunate position, both geography and sort of political economy situation that Vancouver can really serve as a gateway, as a bridge to Asia, and I think that's fantastic. That's an opportunity we should take.
Do you have a, like, we've asked this question of other people in the past, but do you have a market, like another city, that just when you look at it, it reminds you exactly of the Vancouver market, or as close as you can maybe get, like a Sydney or something along those lines?
Yeah, I mean, every city is unique. Obviously, Seattle and San Francisco are also gateway cities, you know, thanks for their geography, but also a bit of the culture. It's not just that. Obviously, Vancouver has unique advantages being located in Canada. So the U.S. immigration policy is more difficult to deal with. I don't know if the rules are stricter, but everything takes longer, and it's more unpleasant,
right.
From what I gather. So because of that, at Simon Fraser University, for example, we get great foreign students, like absolutely fantastic, who actually sometimes have admission offers from top schools in the U.S. And in the end of the day, they come to us partly because, you know, it's much easier to get the paperwork done. There is a clear path later to a work permit, so they obtain some real life experience. So those things matter and they add up. Not one single thing is going to drive the thing, the whole idea,
right.
but it adds up. And because of that, Vancouver is fairly unique.
Maybe switching gears, we've recently been starting our talks. We've been talking to a lot of people in the development industry and kind of in the real estate industry, and we've been asking the question, why real estate? But we've never actually asked an economist or an academic that question. Why are you so interested in real estate? Why study real estate? What's exciting about real estate for you?
Well, there's a pragmatic reason, which is it's relatively under research field. So if you count the number of articles in asset pricing or asset allocation, you get thousands. If you find articles specifically targeted at the real estate market or real estate investments, you still get quite a few, but less. You probably get in the hundreds. So that I saw that as a bit of an opportunity, as a bit of a niche. So that's sort of the pragmatic side. The other side is it really, really, really matters because this is the single buying a home or selling a home or getting a mortgage, those decisions, each one on their own, can have profound consequences for your financial well-being and even emotional well-being.
Right.
It really, really matters. It matters a lot more than your stock portfolio because, I mean, frankly, what was the last time you looked at your stock portfolio, right? You kind of buy it and leave it there, and maybe you pay someone to monitor it, but it does not affect the way you live. Buying the wrong home or getting the wrong mortgage not only can tremendously alter your financial situation, it affects you every day. Every day you're walking through the door and you can love it or not love it, and you can be upset or happy because of those one, two, or three single decisions there. So it matters a lot, and that attracted me.
Right.
Maybe moving on kind of to the market a bit, because we've talked with you about the market. It was a while back now, but What was the most surprising thing about the market this almost past year for you?
Well, clearly the market suffered because of all the speculation and vacancy tax and school tax and all the other housing-related measures that are focused on demand. I think that did reduce demand, especially for high-end properties. So the market suffered from that, and now people appear to be coming back. So transactions are up. I don't know if prices are up quite yet, but usually transactions happen before prices move. For the thinking out there, I think, is that the spring is going to be another strong market, partly because people postpone the decision to buy a home, but they can't postpone forever. Kids are arriving, people are forming families. You do enough of that, you want to get on with your life. Mm-hmm. And so I think all those buyers, they have not gone away. We have not lost population. We certainly have not built anything, hardly anything. So the supply and demand fundamentals are there, meaning we have a housing shortage, a very severe housing shortage. So it's only a matter of time until those buyers who, were like unsure what's going to happen with the BC policies, there's only so much they can hold out, and they appear to be coming back right now.
Right. Did that surprise you? Were you thinking the kind of downturn would be like a longer, more drawn out kind of buyer's market, if you will? It seems like now the sales ratios, at least from the last couple months, we're moving back into seller's market territory. The confidence is back, but looking back now, if that was kind of the downturn, it seemed relatively short. Is that your sense, or were you expecting this?
It is short, but it was pretty severe, especially for high-end properties. Mm-hmm. So it's not to be underestimated. I mean, I know the average price decline was, about 10%, so that doesn't sound like much, even though it's not small, because that will put a lot of people in negative equity territory. But the decline in the higher-end part of the market was much more severe. 20, 30, maybe even 40%. So the decline wasn't small. And then in terms of the timing, well, there's pressure, right? We have population growth. We still have people coming in here. There's a lot of pressure from the fundamental demand, to buy real estate. And as I said already, we've done absolutely nothing on the supply side. So if you're kind of considering buying, you might be worried about prices jumping again, because we have even more people now. We've taken another year or two of population growth with absolutely very little, hardly any supply response.
So do you think we've hit bottom then in the market?
Well, it appears that way, except I worry what other things the government will do. So sure, yes, if the government stops here and if they reverse some of the misguided policies they've put in place, yes, that would be the bottom. But I worry a little bit, because this government, especially at the provincial level, appears to be set on penalizing homeowners. They're not going to be very happy to see homeowners making money, even if that money is just on paper. So the question is, are they going to come up with other policies, and are they going to undermine property rights even more to reduce prices artificially?
What are your thoughts on that? Because it seems to me, I know I have a sense of your thoughts, but what are your thoughts on actual potential policy moves moving forward? Because it seems to me right now, with what we're seeing, especially in the sub $1 million market, where it's pretty robust, I don't think anyone would say all these measures to tackle affordability have actually done much, unless you're looking at the $3.5 million house. Then I think you've gotten a pretty good haircut off what it would have been worth a couple of years ago. But do you sense that there's more policy measures coming down the line?
So before I answer that, I will actually take an issue with improved affordability at any level.
Okay.
So clearly the affordability at the entry level has not been improved. On the contrary, I think it's been made worse. So sure, prices are lower, but prices are not about affordability is not just about price. So lower price is good because it lowers your mortgage amount. But if the terms on the mortgage become harder, and there's suggestion that banks don't like to lend in declining markets. So even if there's no change in policy at the bank level, you know, banks don't are not going to jump in a declining market. So the terms of the financing terms become worse. And then, more importantly, the risk on the equity investment, whatever the homeowner pays, the risk on that investment goes up tremendously. Because you normally have to price in the risk of market fluctuations, maybe oversupply, whatever. Now in BC, we have to factor in the additional risk of what else the government would do. So the cost of that equity goes up because it becomes riskier. So those two things alone make it actually harder to buy even at the lower prices. And then, of course, we have higher taxes, we have higher utility bills and all kinds of things that actually make cost of ownership directly higher. So sure, we've reduced prices, but the cost of ownership has not gone down, in my view. It has gone up. And it's difficult to measure the exact cost of ownership because we don't know exactly what people think about their down payment and what return they expect on that. But I look at the data, and the data is that people were not buying for a long time. So if even though prices declined. So if that was such a good deal, people would have piled on to that, to those lower prices, and it took quite a long time for that to happen. So the cost of home ownership hasn't declined. And on the upper side, the higher end of the market, yeah, sure, the prices have declined there more. So maybe there's some improvement in affordability, but then that requires larger down payment. That requires a more difficult mortgage to begin with because banks don't like to make large mortgages. So those terms, in my view, have become even worse. So I'm not even sure that affordability in that segment has gone up, possibly by a little bit, but certainly not by by quite a bit. So the measures have not improved affordability, in my view. They've reduced prices, but there's a lot more to affordability than price. Now, judging by that track record, your question was, what can we expect? So in the past, clearly, the BC government has taken steps to undermine property rights. So they tell you what you can do with your property, how many nights you can sleep in it, and if you don't, we'll penalize you, right? So I can... I mean, they're imaginative, right? So they... who knows what they'll come up with, but yeah, ultimately, it's going to be telling you what you can do with your property. And the more they do that, they're essentially expropriating property rights. And then at the end, if they say, we have no property rights in BC anymore, then the price will go to zero, right? So the government does have the power to bring the price to any level they want by expropriation. Now, I hope they don't go there, because if they do, I mean, first of all, there will be legal challenges on constitutional grounds, and more importantly, you know, we'll have an election sooner or later, and that's not going to go very well for them. But that's that they have basically unlimited ammunition to expropriate property rights.
It sounds like you're, I guess, going down the kind of the logical conclusion kind of line there. But it sounds like in those terms, I've the NDP is more of an existential threat than I was even thinking. It sounds like you're pretty negative on them.
Yes, you can tell. Well, it's. I wasn't negative when they got elected, but I was negative when they introduced the speculation and vacancy tax in particular, and also the school tax, because in my view, these infringe on property rights. So we are quite literally stealing from homeowners. And if you look at all the other housing measures, they clearly indicate thinking that homeowners are the enemy. And in general, property owners are the enemy, and they need to be penalized and taxed. And you know, we're going to reduce their ability to do what they can rightfully do with their asset in favor of people who don't own, who, you know, I mean, not that I'm cynical, but are more likely to vote for us.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So it sounds like the biggest threat facing the Vancouver real estate market, in your opinion, is the government.
Absolutely. It has been the main issue and for a long time. And I mean, I understand we have an issue of affordability, and that may require some government intervention. But in my view, the intervention should be on the supply side, entirely on the supply side. And it is to stimulate supply. And instead, we have a number of measures that are constricting supply. Just look at the building code or the permitting process. So the government is restricting supply. And then instead of stepping back and relaxing those restrictions, they impose more restrictions on the demand. Well, two wrongs don't make it right. So, and we see that in the market. The market today is not more affordable than it was in the past, despite the lower prices.
Does the Vancouver real estate market, do prices in Vancouver make sense to you? Like when you look at all the other markets in the world that you're studying, you know, you hear a lot of people that are saying, well, look at average salaries or wages or, you know, a variety of different factors that seem to kind of work, used to work more in local context, but maybe don't apply in international markets or in kind of like cities that are kind of considered future cities. But do the metrics in Vancouver make sense, and do the prices make sense to you?
Well, I mean, we know what they are. Vancouver is unaffordable. I don't think there's any question about that, especially for someone making a living here. And I think we are all painfully aware of that. The question is, what's the cause of that? And in my view, the reason is squarely on government restrictions on supply. So for years, we've been providing less supply than we need, and quite a bit less. And I mean, you don't need to take my word for it. Just look at how long it takes for a building application to get approved, even for a basic project. And then add to that building code, and add to that all the restrictions on accessing new land, like the agricultural land reserve. Look at our infrastructure. So our infrastructure is really in very, very bad shape. It's highly insufficient, and that compresses us all into a tight area because you can't commute very far, right? So that constriction of supply is a result of government policy. And you do that for a decade or two, you're going to get high prices because Vancouver is desirable, and we already discussed why.
Yeah.
We've had a gentleman from the States, Teo Nicolai, on a few times. He has talked a lot about, we've just had him on talking about market cycles, right? Like how every real estate market goes through cycles and kind of what to watch for. There's the hyper supply stage where there's a lot of supply on the market that just never seems to happen here. Like how, from your perspective, does Vancouver fit in that larger market cycle at this stage, considering we're just not building enough? And it seems like if there's any cycle happening, it's almost due to government intervention. Like, what are your thoughts on kind of the traditional market cycle in relation to where we're at right now?
Yeah. So the reason we have market cycles in normal real estate markets is that it's difficult to predict demand, and projects take a long time. So if you have a project that takes 2 years to build, you start the project when the demand is high and you can't stop. It's very, very costly to stop. So you complete the project, and you might very well be completing the project when the demand has turned. And that generates cycles. And every normal city would have periods of overbuilding. And then we'll have decline in new starts. And then eventually the economy will pick up, and that supply is going to be absorbed. And in my view, that's just a feature of the real estate markets because it takes so long to build and it's difficult to forecast demand. In Vancouver, we're practically not building. The building that we have is highly insufficient. So because of that, we're never into oversupply situation. Certainly the last market cycle was entirely caused by the government, government-specific intervention to manipulate prices. It was not a fundamental response to change in demand or change in supply. Vancouver is all about, unfortunately, to what the government does. rather than normal market forces. And that makes it riskier. And then because of that, it generates even a bigger market supply shortage.
Mm-hmm. So in like just in talking to people every day, oh, every market goes through cycles. You know, this can't go on forever, that type of thing. It sounds to me like what you're actually saying is, well, it may not be able to go on forever because of things like government interventions. But in fact, if you highly limit the supply, the type of overheated demand could potentially go on forever.
Yes, it could, because we have growing population. Right. So we have growing mm-hmm. population in Canada, growing local population, and we have people coming into Vancouver from the rest of Canada and also the rest of the world. So as long as those three factors are in place, and I can't see how they're going to reverse, the demand is going to keep growing. So the way to get a normal market cycle that, in my view, would be healthy would be to increase supply so much that, you know, even with those three factors, we actually don't have enough buyers, right? So we have oversupply, even all these three factors. But that requires massive increase in supply, not just the, you know, a few thousand units that we get here and there after many years of delay. That basically requires doubling the size of the Lower Mainland over 10 years.
Do you have what's the easiest way to do that? Any thoughts?
Well, it needs to be both density and new land. So clearly, density needs to increase, and I like the idea of not through some sort of hidden, obscure process, but you know, auction the density right. So decide how much density we want to increase in the city, and then auction that to developers. So get developers to pay for the right to increase density. In this way, density will increase where it's most needed, and the developers that need it the most will pay the highest price. I don't know if you know, but this is a proposal by Tom Davidoff that he's had for a while. My modification to that is then take whatever the developers are paying and don't put it in the city coffers. Instead, pay the neighbors. So clearly the neighbors don't like the density. Right. Well, pay them, mm-hmm. right? So have a formula that, you know, it's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be something. If you're within a certain distance, pay, you get, you know, 100,000 compensation. And then if you're a little farther, then you get 10,000. If you're a little farther, then you get 1,000. You get something, right? And I think that will turn neighbors from people who oppose the project to people who like the project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And everyone will be better off. We're going to get the density and we're going to get the existing neighbors being actually quite happy with it. And then, of course, so that's higher density. And then the other way we need to increase supply is through new land. So to me, it's a travesty that we have farms within 15 kilometers of downtown Vancouver. And most of that 15 kilometers is already covered by SkyTrain. So, yeah, sure, I hear arguments about food security or this is the most fertile land, and fine. I'm not saying force the farmers to convert to housing, but give them the right. Don't prevent them from doing that. And if that land is so valuable, they will keep it as farms. And if that land is more valuable as housing, then they'll convert to housing. So let the market decide. And then, of course, you can't just build. You need to extend the SkyTrain to there and improve whatever our transportation infrastructure is. It needs to be improved so that it's quick to go from those new developments to downtown or to other places in the city.
Right. Will light density help with all the changes that's happening with the city right now, like the RT zoning, duplexes, and coach homes coming in? I mean, clearly it's a step in the right direction. Would you agree?
So I have a paper with Tom Davidoff again and then Sur Somerville on the laneway houses. Mm-hmm. So laneway houses is, in my view, when they came along, were a pretty clever way to increase density without too much inconvenience or impact on the neighbors, right? It's what we call gentle densification.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that, indeed, the neighbors of those properties, the properties that end up having laneways, generally don't mind the laneways. The impact is not all that big. But it is substantial, it's statistically significant, and it's big in expensive areas. So if we go to Vancouver West, the impact there is big, right? So I built a laneway that has a substantial impact on my neighbors. So that kind of thinking leads us to places where gentle density is a good thing and everyone's happy about it, and if the neighbors don't mind, and places where it's a big deal and it shouldn't happen.
And when you say, sorry, just to, so I understand, a larger impact in Vancouver West, is it based on kind of just a survey of the neighbors, like their perceived impact of it, or?
Yeah, I'm not very big on surveys because I don't trust people to tell the truth. So what we look at is prices, so transaction prices.
Oh,
so
okay,
we look at homes that transacted.
Right.
And have a laneway next to them versus homes that didn't. And we do it in a whole bunch of different ways. And I believe that because there's real money involved. So people
sure.
rationally respond to what they see in the house and in the neighborhood. And the price impact of a laneway on the neighboring properties is very big in Vancouver West, and basically expensive areas. And it's non-existent, it's really zero, indistinguishable from zero, and could even be positive in lower-priced areas.
Yeah.
So that suggests that this kind of changes, gentle densification, I love it. It's conceptually very appealing to me, but should not be across the city. It should be really across, you know, it should be targeted at different neighborhoods. And our paper, frankly, can be used as a guide for that. So we have data on neighborhood by neighborhood, and we estimate that effect neighborhood by neighborhood. So we know where people don't like this kind of gentle densification, and we know neighborhoods where people are perfectly okay with it. So then that densification should happen where people are okay with it, not where people are upset about it.
So we have... Well, it hasn't happened yet, but we have Gil Kelly coming on the show in the new year. We're really excited about it, but we're... I'm wondering about this idea of the citywide plan. Do you have any thoughts on this? Basically, instead of the official community plans, we're looking at a broader plan for the city of Vancouver. It sounds to me like that's almost a more targeted approach is actually more useful in your mind when it comes to general densification.
So I know we need to densify.
Yeah.
So any steps we take to densify are welcome. Having said that, one plan for Vancouver is the wrong way to do it because the evidence, specifically based on this paper, but you don't have to read that paper, you just know that different neighborhoods like different things. And I know we're all about, we don't want to treat the rich and the poor differently and this and that. That's fine, but we need to understand that certain neighborhoods, people in certain neighborhoods don't like certain forms of densification, and people in other neighborhoods are perfectly happy with them.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, so if we accept that, and I think that's based on our paper, but also based on intuition, if that's the case, then densification should happen where people don't mind it as much
mm-hmm.
or at all.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I mean, I personally don't mind densification. I grew up in a very dense city. I don't mind the noise, and I love people on the streets. I think if we do it right, and those areas become nice and attractive and offer all kinds of services, then everyone else is going to want it too. But the moment you start shoving densification down people's throat where they don't want it, then you kill the whole thing, and you slow down the process of densification mm-hmm. overall. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an interesting idea because it almost seems like so I live in Grandview. I was just thinking about getting paid for development near your house. I mean, one of the things that is going on in my neighborhood is Nanaimo's been basically shut down for a year. I can't turn onto my street. I can't turn onto the street next door because there's duplexes being built in the RT5, which I'm all for. There's multifamily going up a couple blocks over. And in my mind, I'm thinking the payoff is actually that Nanaimo, which I saw as kind of a disaster for the city. It's just this wasted kind of highway that runs north-south. I don't, disaster might be strong, but an arterial that's an arterial that's not very exciting is actually going to be traffic calmed, it appears, with more people on the street, more amenities closer to my house.
Walkable. Like
it's actually going to make my neighborhood in the
eventually
end.
Good restaurants, grocery stores, cafes.
Exactly. So it's a lot better. But actually, in my mind, just when you're talking between East and West and a big move towards East Vancouver, it's almost because of that already existing in a lot of ways, right? Like a lot of those neighborhoods on the west side, potentially, I guess there's an exclusivity to it, which is why prices presumably are impacted by gentle density, right? But in the end, I think you're right, because everybody seems to be moving to the east side, and the west side doesn't seem to have that kind of the vibrancy that street life and the things you're talking about actually have. So presumably over time, market forces will actually help incentivize in the right direction, if we're thinking gentle density is the right direction.
Yeah, and it's not going to be just market forces. People are going to start changing their mind, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of seeing density as a pure negative, people are going to say, oh, that's pretty nice. Now I have restaurants and stores and coffee shops and people on the streets. I kind of like that. Okay. And I get paid for it, you know? Well, I'm all for it. Can we have it, right? So then instead of developers fighting to get density rights, it's going to be the homeowners fighting to attract developers, right? Sure. And that kind of situation, you get fantastic outcome for everyone, and we get the density that we need without forcing really anyone to do anything they don't want.
And the city's listening to homeowners, purportedly. Right? That's the idea. So, I mean, if the homeowners are, if people from the community are actually voicing their opinion and wanting
Support, right? Support, as opposed to
it's support
being shut down
right now.
Throats.
Exactly. No, that makes a lot of sense.
So that supposedly is a big point in my view, because I'm not sure who the city of Vancouver is listening to, because many of their policies are not really helping homeowners either. But that aside, absolutely. Right. There is a serious point there. If we get homeowners and developers on the same side,
right,
even a city like the city of Vancouver will go along.
Have to listen. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can we talk about, have you guys done any studies about like larger multifamily developments and the communities that would embrace like high density projects? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, or even like
sub areas.
48 units or like not even a high rise, actually. That's
because, I mean, when you look at, like, when people look at the city of Vancouver, a lot of people wonder, well, what's going to basically get upzoned and has the potential for becoming kind of more, you know, like a like a Brentwood, right? Or something along those lines. Do you, any areas in Vancouver specific that you would look at and say it seems ripe for development?
Yeah, so I have a paper on that which uses the Rental 100 program in Vancouver, which gives density bonus if you develop a purpose-built rental. And so we study the effects. We look at every project that has gone up under that program, and then we study the effects on the neighbors. And it's, so first of all, if the neighbors are condo owners, no impact. In fact, they kind of like it, because probably the Rental 100 building is replacing something that's run down or old or crumbling or ugly or whatever. Even the homeowners there don't mind it that much. So we do find a small negative effect, but that effect is not significant. So that means it could be zero. So the Rental 100 program, wherever we see those apartments being built, clearly that program has been successful, because it appears that the neighbors are not particularly upset about that higher density. So that's a nice clean experiment, because you get a higher density on the same piece of land.
You've already done this paper on the Rental 100, so that would be a good paper to kind of, I guess, basically as a guide for where there seems to be more acceptance.
That's right. That's
and
right.
Was so, that in the city of Vancouver or was it in Metro Vancouver?
Well, Rental 100 is a city of Vancouver just problem, got to be.
So it's got just within the confines of Vancouver.
Yeah, right? So that'd be a good start. Wherever those projects went up, that'd be a very good start for densification because we have evidence that those neighbors don't mind it so much.
We'll link to that on that paper.
But
on
is
our
that
website.
So? I'm just thinking. Yeah, it's asking for a friend. But would that be? Is that a good start for? If I understand correctly, places where developers should be looking to do further projects because of that, or is? Yeah, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. Because clearly, we have evidence that people there don't mind. And then the other conclusion of the paper is that condo owners don't mind the new density, not nearly as much as single family owners. Right. So then that naturally implies that the new density should be adjacent to existing high density. I think that's a very natural way to go rather than a skyrise here, a skyrise there. You know, that wouldn't work so well.
Right. I have kind of a question. It's a little bit shifting gears, but it's just going back to kind of this idea of government intervention and kind of price compression. So we've seen, as we kind of talked about earlier, at the low end of the market here, a lot of pressure, and I think we're seeing kind of upward pressure now on the lower, like one beds are on fire right now. And you were involved in multiple offers last night where we're setting new records in
$150,000 over asking, and seemed not that far.
$650K for a one bed's not,
and it landed at $790,000.
So almost $800K, and that's at Main and Broadway, right? So that's not even downtown. So we're seeing upward pressure on that one bedroom, and we're seeing downward pressure at the higher end. Anything I would say. Still over, 2.5, 2.8 on the west side seems to be.
Yeah, and that example isn't like an outlier. This past weekend downtown for one beds, there was a few one beds that weren't even considered bait prices that had 90 groups through on a Saturday, right? So, I mean, we're talking like blanketed in the city of Vancouver, one beds right now are very, very active, right?
Yeah. I just called somebody on the east side where in Strathcona where even 6 months ago it was pretty slow and multiple offers on two units today.
It was our deal of the month 6 months ago.
Yeah, there you go. But we're still seeing kind of upward pressure and we've said on the podcast before, we have a guy who famously said, you know, everything's going to be $1 million at one point because, you know, it's just everything's moving in that direction. At the same time, there's people out there that are saying, okay, this doesn't, there's a trickle down from lower prices at the high end, like it's going to move through the market, but it doesn't seem to have done that at all. What are your thoughts on that idea of kind of lower prices at the high end trickling through the market? Does that actually make sense to you? I hear that all the time.
Yeah, sure. The markets are connected. It takes time, but you can't have compression for a long time because, well, two reasons. First, the seller of that condo you just described, well, now they're $150,000 richer. Where are they going to go, right?
West Vancouver.
There you go. Well, possibly, but
no,
you get the idea, right? Yeah. So certainly that person is richer, quite a bit richer than they thought.
Yeah.
So they're, and they need to live somewhere. Now, some of them are going to be leaving town, but some are going to be coming back. Overall, that's going to translate eventually into higher prices for higher end properties. Mm-hmm. Because of the sellers of those condos you're describing.
Sure.
And then at the same time, at some point people are going to say, well, if I can only spend another $200,000-$500,000, which I know is real money, but, you know, the interest cost on that is not that much. So if I can only do that on top of what I'm already doing, well, then I get a house, right? Mm-hmm. And then I get a house on a quiet street, right? And then, those things are connected. It takes time, right? But
So we've seen, I would say it's basically the stress test that has kind of created that price. I guess foreign buyer's tax. It's really been kind of, I don't know, the stress test, it seems,
policy.
Seems like it's been, that
but the
was
gap is, your point is the gap is very narrow.
And it seems to, but we're almost 2 years
deep, right? That was end of 2017 was the stress test.
Yeah.
So we're kind of 2 years deep. But you're saying that this kind of price compression we've been seeing, yeah, is not going to last forever. And in fact, it's not. It's probably not long for this world, because at some point the gap's just not wide enough and it doesn't make sense. And
people will jump back into the higher price points.
That's right. So the gap will increase. Now, I don't know whether it's the high end is going to increase in price or the low end is going to decline, but based on what you said, it sounds like the higher end is going to start increasing too.
Right.
Those markets are linked. You cannot have small differences between vastly different properties, because we know what we like, right? And people will jump on the type of properties they like. Now, in terms of the stress test, so the stress test was clearly very beneficial when it was introduced, because interest rates were about to go up and they could have very easily gone up 2%. That was like the thinking at the time. That wasn't even that extreme. Now, no one's talking about interest rate increases. Everyone's talking about zero interest rates or even negative, right?
Right.
So the question I have is, why are we still keeping the stress test under the current market conditions? And more importantly, I can understand the stress tested purchase, but stress tested mortgage renewal makes absolutely no sense, right? Because it doesn't help the borrower in any way. You're not going to sell your home because interest rates might go up 2%, right? So what it does is it locks borrowers with the bank they're currently with.
Right, and they're not allowed to shop around.
And so this is really this is, to be very blunt, theft from the borrowers and a gift to the lenders.
I experienced that firsthand recently. but we're talking to people that are experiencing it all the time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, especially it depends what you're doing and refinancing, and it's a tricky time still. You know,
It seems like it's
although kind of, it's loosened.
It seems
considerably.
Like it's loosened up a little bit, but shopping around kind of 5 years in, if your situation's changed,
it's very difficult.
Well, the rules have changed. Yeah. That's for sure. So,
What are your thoughts on the market in 2020?
Well, I mean, I think we covered some of that. So clearly, people are coming back into the market. Mm-hmm. So if unless the government intervenes with other creative ways to penalize homeowners, I think we're going to see a pretty fast recovery. Mostly because the demand has been building up. We have more people moving in, more people being born, families being formed. All of that is on track. Hasn't really changed. And we've built very, very little. And we're building less today.
Right.
So with those two, demand being on the rise as normal, and then supply being highly constricted, at some point that's going to translate into higher prices.
Do you have a guess if there is another policy change potentially coming, any thoughts on what it might be?
Yeah, so given the track record of the current government, it's they have signaled that they have no problem reducing or undermining the property rights of current owners.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they don't see that as a cost. I think they see homeowners as the enemy who's made money and now needs to be penalized. So
do you think it's lowering the school tax, or is there anything specifically you think that
hiring?
Well, meaning lowering the threshold.
Oh, lowering the threshold. That's what I was thinking. Or hiring the amount, right?
So, yeah. I mean, but there was proposal already to lower the threshold to $1 million. So the school tax now applies to property over $3 million. So the idea is to apply it starting at $1 million, right? Yeah. So that's one thing they can do. They can raise the tax itself, which is already huge. But that's another thing they can do. Clearly, the speculation and vacancy tax also can be expanded, because, they can, in two ways. One is they can increase the rates, but more importantly, they can make it even stricter on what you can and cannot do with your property. So they can impose further restrictions on what you're allowed to do with your property. So there's a whole bunch of mechanisms they have. I don't know which one they'll choose, but ultimately, it may very well, in fact, very likely, it will reduce property rights. It's going to undermine property rights for all the property owners.
So with all this said, it sounds like you're still fairly bullish on 2020. You think that based on what we're seeing now, it's going to translate to a fairly busy spring, barring any kind of fairly, well, maybe not so big change. These are fairly minor things that would have huge impacts, though, I guess, the type of interventions you're talking about. But would you be buying property in Vancouver right now?
Well, I mean, so if I think 10 or 20 years from now, the demand will be there. It's a nice place. Other governments around the world have screwed things up so bad that, you know, it makes us stand out as good. It's only on a relative basis, not on absolute basis, but still. And I don't see that changing, right? I don't see, you know, governments around the world certainly, you know, straightening up and doing the right thing. So the demand is going to be there. We're clearly not building, nowhere near enough. So with those two factors, that only has one way to go. So the only unknown is, you know, as I said, government intervention. But even that is limited because we have an election coming up one way or another. And there is a limit to how much people will take in terms of abuse from the government before they stand up and kind of vote this government out of power.
And I just have one other question. This is more of asking for a friend investor question. But in terms of property type, what would you, if you were buying in 2020, what would you buy?
Mm-hmm. Well, to be frank, I like buying land because we're certainly not accessing more land. Right, mm-hmm. We have more land in the Lower Mainland. It's not true that we're running out of land, but the obstacles to accessing new land are just enormous. So I don't see that ever happening. So the way we're going to increase supply is through densification. And when someone comes and tries to do a land assembly, you get paid per square foot of land, not per square foot of building or anything like that.
Right.
You know, if I can't give advice, but if I was doing something, I'd buy the biggest possible lot in the nicest possible location, regardless of the structure.
Right.
Good advice. Maybe we'll leave it there, Andre, but we have this quick segment called the Five Wire, five quick questions about Vancouver. Can you stick around for that?
Of course.
Okay. So question number one, what is your favorite neighborhood in Vancouver?
Well, I kind of like Kitsilano because it's a mixture of high density, low density. It offers all kinds of property types.
Right.
It's close to downtown. It's very vibrant, close to the beach. So, you know, I mean, I don't want to limit it to Kitsilano, but that kind of thing that offers various forms and various densities,
right,
all within walking distance, I think that's very attractive.
It was also the home of a very famous debate we once had on the podcast, the Davidoff-Pavlov debate of 2018.
So the question is, does that improve or worsen the neighborhood?
Favorite bar or restaurant in Vancouver?
Well, I like sushi, so and pretty much any sushi place around town. I live in Dunbar, so there's a neighborhood place near there that I kind of like.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very good. We've got some great sushi options.
Yes.
What is one piece of advice that you'd give your 18-year-old self?
Not Vancouver specific.
Yeah. I don't know why I always say that.
Yeah, not Vancouver specific. Well, so I saw a great little poster that said, teach your kids don't buy your kids what you wanted to have, teach them what you wanted to know. So pretty much anything, learn anything, you know, yeah. Learn how to hammer a nail and learn how to solve a differential equation and you know, whatever fits, but learn more. And yeah. I learned a ton, obviously, but certainly not enough. I would have liked to learn a hell of a lot more.
Yeah, that's actually that's a great one.
That's a good one.
Yeah. One of the best answers I think we've had for that question.
Learn more. And if you didn't learn enough, think about us.
Well, the thing is, I spent a lot of years in school, right? Yeah. I don't know to what extent that translates into learning, number one. And number two, I learned very specific things. So what I'm talking about is learn general life skills.
You're like a renaissance man.
And I mean, this is an interesting question for an academic and a professor, but do you have a book that you would recommend for listeners? And maybe not something that's too academic or technical.
Well, so there's lots. I like books like The Big Short.
Right.
I mean, so there is a movie. You know, frankly, I wasn't quite so excited by the movie, but the book I thought was excellent. And it's not. It goes into too much detail for most people, I think. But there is one lesson there that is, a lot of people can do the wrong thing for a long time. So a lot of people can be going down the wrong path for a long time. And it refers to the mortgage-backed securities in the financial crisis. A ton of people were buying these things as if they were safe and sound and secure. And of course, they were not. So the biggest lesson then is, well, try to think differently. So any book that gives you examples of benefits of thinking differently from everyone else, you know, I think that'd be a good book.
Avoid the Herd.
Avoid the Herd, yes.
Avoid the Herd.
Last question.
Last question for you. What is something you've bought in the last year or two for under $1,000 that's changed your life?
All right, so we were talking about renting on the way here with Chris. So I didn't buy anything over $1,000. I rented. So I rented a Lamborghini with, you know, as a birthday present for my 9-year-old, and that was in lieu of all other presents and all parties. Nice. And everything. And
you let him
as
drive?
Wasteful as that was, yeah, no, I didn't do that
on the back.
but as wasteful as that was, it was such a pleasure to go for a Sunday drive. You know,
yeah,
just half an hour with my kid. That was phenomenal.
I feel like there's a lot of things out there like that that you should just rent. You know, like there's a lot
one
of
one being a Lamborghini.
One of them, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
But yeah. but the idea of an experience there is a great answer. The experience over
that's
there.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. I wouldn't buy anything. I don't think I bought anything over $1,000, period. But even if I did, I think that would change my mind.
Yeah.
My life. But experience, yeah, travel or some experience that.
Yeah.
And last question, how did it handle?
The Lamborghini. You only said 5 questions.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for your time, Andre. That was a fascinating conversation, as it always is.
Yeah.
How can people learn more about what you're doing? I know you're big on Twitter.
Twitter. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's my. And I write quite a bit of op-eds for the Vancouver Sun and other outlets. And happy, of course, to share any of my papers.
Great. We might actually, yeah, if we'd love to link to the Rental 100 paper that we discussed. Sounds
yeah.
super interesting.
I mean, also the gentle density.
Or we'll
stuff on
sure.
there.
Or we'll yeah. Or we'll link to the J store, and they'll just have to get a membership.
Well, the rental, yeah. No, the rental one is not published yet. It's still work in progress, so that one's free. The other one, I have to check what the status of it, whether it's free or not. But we'll abide by the copyright rules. We're not gonna.
Sounds good. Well, thanks again. Thanks again for your time.
Of course. Thank you.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Andre Pavlov, professor from the Beattie School of Business out at SFU.
Matt, that was a great conversation. And I'm just curious, do you still have your JSTOR password?
Because
from your university days. Because yeah. I was trying to think, what was the other one? Biblio? There was
no,
J Host?
EBSCO Host?
EBSCO Host.
Yeah.
That was,
I wonder if that's still around. I feel like that was like stuff that couldn't survive a improvements.
There is not 1 ounce of me that ever wants to review an academic article again. Not even a...
Unless it's Andre Pavlov.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless he's doing very interesting
he's
stuff.
He's doing very
and
interesting.
And he sent us some stuff that we can link to.
About none of it's postmodern.
But it's very specific to Vancouver.
Right.
And where density needs to be. There's a variety of very interesting questions that people are going to want to look at. You can do that at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. The other thing is, so many people
got in touch with us.
Yes.
So many people got in touch with us after we had Rochelle and Alyssa from Epic Alliance on. Cash flow, $500 a month on a 200K, 40K actual in real hard cash investment.
Right.
So many people are excited about that. So many people have reached out. If you haven't heard it, go back and listen to that episode. If you're looking for something cash flow positive, it's pretty tough in Vancouver, but one place it isn't, and it's also hassle-free, is Saskatoon. Those guys are doing it right, and it's an amazing opportunity.
And if for only one reason to go back and listen to it, the interview starts that they met in prison. And so
Leave it
there. Yeah, exactly. What else do we have for today, Matt?
We got Larry Beasley's signed book. We're giving away a signed copy of Larry Beasley's book. We're also giving a copy of Jody Vetrell's book,
Beyond the Banks.
Beyond the Banks. Both these books are being given away this week. The way to get into this draw, very simple. You Google Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. You look on the right-hand side. There is a business profile. You hit review. You write a review. You are entered into Secret's draw. He pulls a name or two in this case every week. And a lot of the people that have reviewed this podcast have won.
Yes, it is a secret draw.
It is a secret. It is a secret draw. So without further ado, who's getting Larry Beasley's signed copy this week?
Secret?
The winner is Jimmy Yargo.
Yargo.
That sound, you said that with confidence.
Yeah. Was it a silent J? I don't trust that you pronounced that correctly, Secret.
What did Jimmy say?
Jeremy Yarger.
What did Jimmy have to say?
He said, recently discovered this podcast. It is great. Super concise, varied topics, and high quality guests. I'm learning a ton as we continue our local real estate journey. Thanks, guys.
Yerny.
All right, and now we're going to give – so congrats, Jimmy. Get in touch. We'll get you that book. We also got the second book giveaway. This is Jody Vetrell's book, Secret. We got a winner?
The winner is Philip Jolling.
Jeez.
You got to be kidding.
You got to be – are you just – is it all the silent J's?
You're just searching J and,
yeah,
and
yeah.
Picking
what's going
a winner
on here? And also, what's with your name pronunciations? I don't even think I can recreate that. That's not how you pronounce that last name. We'll have Philip get in touch and he can pronounce his name.
What did Philip say?
He says, great podcast. Highly recommend this podcast to anyone who wants to learn more about Canadian real estate.
That's it.
Thanks, Secret. That was good. Get in touch, Philip, and we'll get you that book. And what else do we got?
We got our website, Matt.
Right. We got VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com where we got tons of resources. Things like our research tool, private client services.
Matt, if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information at your fingertips. It's free. It's the best resource out there. We've tried them all. Sign up today for your free account at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
If you're not using PCS, you're doing it wrong. We also got the Livewire. We got the stats.
Tons of stats. And we're actually going to be focusing more on stats because we're getting a lot of good feedback on stats. And also, we've been working a little bit to get some stats out there that UDI appreciates. No big whoop.
Have you heard of them? Yeah. Anyway, we got all this at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Sign up over there. If you want to talk to me about this or anything else real estate related, give me a call at 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And if you're interested in UTIs, we have another line for you.
Jinfo at...
Two Thousand Faces for Radio.
Subscribe today.